I spent time growing in Zimbabwe and South Africa. It was amazing to see people spending 80, 85% of their income on fertilizers and pesticides and things like that. And you know, imagine if someone like that got contaminated with a GMO crop. He doesn't have the money to go buy that next year. He's spending, you know, almost all of his income on just growing the one crop he has so that he can grow it again next year, because the profit margins aren't there, you know? So it really does make a huge difference in people's lives. So that's why having a free tool that's AI based that they can pull up in their language and get the instructions they need exactly for their plot based on local resources that they don't have to buy. Now that's going to give that guy a lot of money that he can spend on literally anything else that's more important in his life.
Welcome back to AI Unchained. We have Potent Ponics, by the way. I like that. I like that that name. I'm not even sure what that is, but you are Stephen Reisner, as I pronounce it.
Yep, Stephen Reisner, and Reisner. My company is Potent Ponics. So.
Potent Ponics. Gotcha. Yeah. Well, I was a Jack Spirko from the Survival Podcast got us in touch because you have a really, really interesting project about, and I've been really interested in kind of diving down this direction, because the entire AI space has been dominated by kind of media, especially in the LLM sense, has been dominated in the, what kind of media can we do? Let's get it to write articles for us. Let's get it to summarize stuff. Can it translate stuff? It's all very, I don't know, I guess white collar, so to speak. It's very like, it's not like hands-on in the real world information focused. It's very much like, are you a digital graphics, you know, like kind of person? And how do we help those tools? Which it makes sense as a software, it's a programming tool, but it's really a way to store and access knowledge. So what you have built is really interesting in that regard, and kind of the direction that you guys are taking, because it's more of a blue collar focus. It's more of a, how do you have a kind of a repository and a way to interact with knowledge for stuff that you can do and use in the real world, as opposed to generating an image or summarizing a podcast episode, you know? So that has really interested me. So that's why I'm getting you on the show. By the way, welcome to AI Unchained. And why don't you give a short introduction to you and the project for the audience?
Sure. My name is Stephen Reisner. I have a consulting agricultural consulting company, mainly on aquaponics and living soil, called Potent Ponics. I also have a YouTube channel of the same name. We have a bunch of free education out there and a podcast called Growing with Fishes, where we try to just disseminate that information out for people as much as possible that's on all those topics. I work closely with a group called Copyleft Cultivars. I'm on the board of Copyleft Cultivars, and we have this amazing project utilizing AI to allow for to kind of crowdsource all these different forms of organic cultivation and make them accessible in many, many, many different languages, and kind of democratize a lot of this stuff that's really kind of been locked up in the English language in terms of education potential. The Copyleft Cultivars is originally founded based on a methodology where there was some unscrupulous stuff that went along in some of the medicinal plant industries. I'll be careful with my language on that so we don't get you demonetized. There was some people that were doing some very untoward things. And one of the ways to fight some of the weird patent stuff that was going on with plants was to register them in a similar method that you do with software and copy left. So they developed an agricultural pathway utilizing, the blockchain to register these genetics and tie them to a piece of software so that now it can be registered into a public domain and there's a blockchain record of it and they can't be stolen or patented. There's many different types of plants that have been kind of locked down by the pharmaceutical industry or this, that, or the other, and kind of kept away from the access to the public. I mean, you see this with some of the corn varieties where farmers get pollinated and then their field has to be cut down, right? Because it has those other genetics in it that are now, you know, that are technically patented. So this is a way to help fight against all that in a way that's affordable for farmers or even indigenous people and in different countries to register their genetics and prevent them from corporate exploitation, or it basically is a defensive mechanism. So that's what Copyleft Cultivar was originally founded on, which is a whole separate topic, which would be fun to talk to you about one day. But what we developed a bunch of different tools collectively as our team. We have about 14 people on the team now that are working on different aspects. We have lawyers, we have software engineers, we have the guy that helps with the agricultural consulting plant portion. That's my part of the team. But we have a bunch of different people that are super high up experts in their field. We have a bunch of people from different universities that teach AI or teach agriculture that are in some pretty well-known universities that you'd be surprised at who they are, which is super cool to have access to the team. So we've developed a whole AI, two different types of AI right now that will allow for the democratization of this stuff. So basically what happens is you punch in where you are in the world, what size your garden is, and then ask it if you need pest help or fertilizer help. And based on your crop choice and your location and your size of your particular farm or grow beds, it will give you customized nutrient applications specifically for your area. So if you want to make something using natural farming methods, which is taking local plants and fermenting them or turning them into compost and putting them in, you can balance out the nutrient content of those different weeds or invasive plants or whatever it is that's in your area that's going to be best utilized, so that you have your nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium and all your different required nutrients in the ratios that are going to provide, you know, ample yields for your crops. It's not just trying to get it over the hump. It's trying to actually make sure that you have similar parts per million values to what you would have with, you know, synthetic fertilizers, so that you can guarantee that your yields are going to be, you know, dialed into that same range. And it really has evolved quite a lot since the beginning, when we first had just a couple of different nutrient tables. And now we have all these different people sending us all these different grow methods from around the world with nutrient data, and crowdsourcing it with a bunch of universities. And it's really kind of snowballing much quicker than we anticipated. So it's really been a wonderful project. And we'll demonstrate some of the examples of what it can do here in a few minutes. But that's kind of the gist of it. And it's, you know, I really am grateful for the amazing team that we have. Caleb is the head of our team over there. Mm-hmm. Maybe get him on one day to talk about the more of the AI engineering side of it. I can't explain all of the different things that they're doing over there, but I know a lot of it. But he's kind of the guru that holds everything together on the team, and Maria and a bunch of others that are really kicking butt and taking names with making the software work.
Hell yeah. All right. So actually, before we get into kind of the AI side of it specifically, the idea of patenting, and I think copyright and the patent issue is actually deeply intertwined with AI. It very much feels like the same sort of conflict that the internet had with media copyright, that the technology fundamentally changes our relationship to it, to the point where the old way that we thought about the legal structure, I mean, granted, if you ask somebody like me, I think the legal structure around it was always antiquated, always basically at odds with the natural reality of information. But the internet just made it blaringly obvious when it came to media that, you know, like, it's easier to have control over physical media. It's a whole hell of a lot. It's a very different story to do that with digital. And in this same sense, AI is, these LLMs are being trained on, and in many cases trained on, a corpus of data that has copyright involved. And as you say, copyleft cultivar, which is from the kind of copyleft idea of trying to protect from the copyright problem, for people give them open source, open domain sort of access to a lot of information and I guess just knowledge in general. But the idea that, you know, a crop could get quote unquote contaminated with genetics that somebody owns, that somebody has patented, and then they have to cut down all of their crop seems flatly retarded, for lack of a better word. Like, you can't, like to think that you could control or own something that you put out in the wild. Like, and I don't mean like put it on the wild, like you put it on the internet, like actually in the fucking wild. Like, you know, like it's in, like it's life. Like I can't like patent a tree and then plant it somewhere. And then every time it pops up in somebody else's yard, I go sue them to say that they have to fucking, I have to cut it down. Like it just, that seems insane to me. How does that really happen? Like at scale? Like,
oh yeah.
Unravel this situation a little bit more, because I guess I knew rumors of it or like little pieces of stuff like that, but I've never dug into it. This seems like a whole world that I'm just not even aware of.
Yeah, corn and soybeans both have this problem quite heavily, where the majority of the genetics in the United States are GMO, and if they get pollinated, you can't save that grain or save that seed for sale, because it now contains the genetic material of the Monsanto, you know, glyphosate-resistant strain or whatever it is that they have, or their mold-resistant one or their BTI strain, which BTI is okay if it's producing Bacillus thuringiensis. That's not a chemical problem in terms of human safety, but it's the patent problem with the pollen. It becomes an issue. And this is now becoming an issue in some of the medicinal plant industries in the United States, where you're having people with triploid genetics and some of these others that are, you know, becoming an issue with the, you know, pollen again from your neighbor now completely screwing up your field or pollinating it and now having seed production. You didn't want seeds, or, you know, some of these other issues that, you know, now it's contaminated. So you can't even like regrow your own crops if you pollinated it, because some of the genetics has this patented stuff in it.
Not they don't yeah. You don't own them. That's crazy. That's ridiculous.
And this isn't a problem everywhere. It's mainly a problem in the US and a couple of other countries. Yeah. But you know, parts of Europe and Russia don't have this problem in terms of the registration. I worked with a group in Russia long time ago, before the war and all that, and they have some of the most insane registrations. You have to register every pesticide per crop, not even like for use in plants, but like on a per crop basis. It's pretty wild. It'd be nice if the US could adopt some of these more stricter agricultural processes like Europe does and some of the other parts of the world, because it would help eliminate some of these issues. But it's a huge problem. The other thing too is you can have viruses, on a separate side, you can have viruses spread through pollen as well. So you could even have, you know, someone intentionally, maliciously, you know, release a viroid infected pollen if someone was really trying to cause a lot of chaos and yeah. screw up a crop too, you know, and that could also be a problem. But yeah, it's a huge issue with the industrial ag. You know, you have like three companies control like 85% of the seed production or 90% of the seed production of the world right now. That's not good for genetic diversity. And you know, if we have a huge problem with the climate or some other catastrophe that happens on a global scale, you know, we need to have a really diverse genetic pool of food crops. And if we don't, we're screwed as a species. Like, this is a bigger existential problem. And that's where, I mean, I spent time growing in Zimbabwe and South Africa before the virus that shall not be named hit. And it was amazing to see people spending 80-85% of their income on fertilizers and pesticides and things like that. And you know, imagine if someone like that got contaminated with a GMO crop. He doesn't have the money to go buy that next year. He's spending, yeah. you know, almost all of his income on just growing the one crop he has so that he can grow it again next year, because the profit margins aren't there, you know? So it really does make a huge difference in people's lives. So that's why having a free tool that's AI-based that they can pull up in their language and get the instructions they need exactly for their plot based on local resources that they don't have to buy. Now that's going to give that guy a lot of money that he can spend on literally anything else that's more important in his life. And that's mm-hmm. where, you know, kind of the goal of this project. I started a project about 2 years ago called Open Nutrient Project with this in mind, without the AI portion of it, where we built a huge spreadsheet. Well, I built a huge spreadsheet with all thousands and thousands and thousands of different plants' nutrient values. And it was perfect. Right when this AI stuff came out, with the LLMs, it was like perfect for feeding into that and formatting it with the different formulas that we had. And it's worked. That's really awesome. Great. It's to kind of, you know, work synergistically with something that I already kind of had in mind. So that was really neat. But it's also giving us new recipes for stuff that we've never even thought of. So there's a methodology in natural farming called IMO, which is indigenous microorganisms, where you mm-hmm. collect the local fungi and soil microbes in a concentrated form using rice. Well, there's a couple different steps to getting to the final plant usable product, but in the fourth stage, in the fourth step that you normally do, It's actually adding mineral-based nutrients to that and creating a whole new mineral output that no one's ever had before. So it's even teaching us new organic methodologies by combining the best pieces of different ones as well, which has been really cool and I think could be really groundbreaking, again, for that same farmer that's spending 85% of his income on that, that doesn't have money to lose his crops to pollen or whatever else. He now has even new options that were not even available to him, you know, even if he had been learned. So, you know, it really is kind of a cool tool that and is teaching us a lot of neat things.
So was it actually able to pull together a novel approach that worked?
Yep. Yeah, we actually tried. We have three different people testing it now at a pretty big scales, and it's working. Yeah. Just by changing it from bran or another, you know, basic input to a more plant-based one, it's working just as well in terms of the fungal output while giving us much higher nutrient outputs for that the final product.
So explain to me in layman's terms what that process is. You said you're using rice to collect or source or distribute like a bacteria or a nutrient-based thing. Explain that again.
Sure. So IMO is a Korean natural farming methodology, which is one of the best things you can put in your garden. So what you do is you take rice and you cook it about 80-85% of the way, and then you turn it off, strain it, and then put that out in an open weave basket for about 4 or 5 inches deep for 5 days. And you keep a screen on it just to keep the rodents out and a little cover to keep the rain off of it so it doesn't get any more moist. Mm-hmm. You put it in an old, undisturbed area of your property and you'll collect the saprophytic fungi and bacteria and yeasts and all the different local microbes that are keeping that local, you know, forest healthy and happy. So now you have that in a concentrated form. Then you cut that 50% with sugar. And then you're going to cut that to stabilize it. Then you're going to take that, brew it up, and put that onto local soil and bran in step 3 and 4 to generate and bulk it out so that you have, you know, many, many, many yards of it in a concentrated form with mulch or whatever your medium is. So there's a very specific methodology that they used in KNF with the ingredients, which was pretty low in nutrient content. It was just kind of like rice husks or, you know, stuff they had laying around in large quantities, but not necessarily thinking about it in terms of a nutrient input. Well, what the AI is doing is replacing that with local dried plant inputs to do the same thing and ending up with really high nutrient parts per million values because it replaced an ingredient that didn't have any nutrient parts per million in it with, you know, local plants that you can have. I want to make this one high in potassium or high in calcium or high in phosphorus. And then I can go pick those local plants that have a lot of that in it and then let it break it down at that stage before it even goes to the plants. And then we take that and either brew it in water and apply it as a liquid, or we'll take that now super enriched mulched fungi, fungi rich mulch and put that right out onto the fields in a spreader with a spreader. And that inoculates the whole field with all of those concentrated microbes. And it's great for healing fungal diseases, healing diseased trees, and treating a lot of, even preventing insects. You can do an insect version where you cut 30% of the rice with insect frass in order to make a pesticide out of it using just the local microbes. What's so cool about it is you're not taking anything that's foreign. You're just utilizing the microbes that are on the property. It kind of taught us a whole new way that we can utilize those microbes to get even more nutrients at an earlier stage, with our methodologies.
Wow. That's so crazy to think about. And it lends itself to a theory that I talk about a lot, that like the overwhelming majority of innovation and kind of technological advancement is just in figuring out how to properly use or bridge knowledge that we have in different categories, like in kind of different disciplines. Is that, you know, there are people in maybe in biology or in oil drilling or whatever it is, like in these different domains that have a certain perspective and have a certain base of knowledge. And there are almost invariably, I mean, potentially an unlimited number of ways that if someone within oil drilling had the biological knowledge, or in somebody in biology had just that little bit of drilling knowledge, that they could actually combine something in a very unique way that is actually insanely applicable, because you know, the world isn't actually separated up into these different disciplines. These are all just kind of human categories and separate narratives or separate maps that we build for how the world works. So figuring out how to connect those maps is actually where the overwhelming majority of progress lies. Because everybody has a different map and nobody's map is the whole thing. Like everybody's map is just 0.1% of 0.1% of 0.1% of anything that is even close to what is real, you know? So it lends itself to this idea that LLMs, that these tools can actually be a huge force for innovation and novel ideas, because most innovation and novel ideas is just combining things that we already know in a different way. And just from the, like in the same way that I can say, to let's say an image diffusion model or something, I can say, draw me a man on a horse, a man on a unicorn on the moon. And that picture may have never existed anywhere on the internet. It's the first time that this picture has ever existed, but it can create it just from the concepts itself. That's fascinating that the LLM actually had a novel input on how to utilize multiple tools that hadn't been utilized in exactly that way to create a better output for a certain approach that you already had for, addressing a nutrient and a kind of defensive mechanism for growing plants. That's so crazy.
Yeah, it's really been a lot of fun to combine these huge nutrient data tables, because lots of universities have different, published stuff that you can readily accessible for Dr. Duke's phytosanitary database is a great example of one, where they have these huge published databases that are freely accessible, that have all these different nutrient data. But no one's ever applied that with AI to kind of, make it much more useful, especially for the fertilizer side. And also combining it with the geolocation data, so that you can pick, I just want to use invasive plants so that I can help my local region. It'll give you formulations based just on that, which is, a great way to kind of, teach people how to, make much better use of all this stuff that otherwise is going to be a problem, in your particular area,
Yeah. I'm curious. So you said that you had already pulled together a huge knowledge base or a spreadsheet or whatever of a bunch of stuff. Tell me about that specifically, and how easy was it to tie that into how the information had to be prepared for the LLM? Because that's something that we've dug into on the show a little bit. Sure. There's a great a Bitcoin and AI industry report by Tsvetsky and the Spirit of Satoshi team. And one of the things that they specifically did in that report is they literally broke down their entire process. Basically, this is what we thought things were going to be like in collecting the data, and then this is what we saw as the reality, and it changed our perspective on a lot of stuff. And they kind of went through bullet point by bullet point, and that was really interesting because it actually revealed a lot of misconceptions that I had about how these tools are built. So maybe expand on how you pulled that information together to begin with, like before even the LLM world kind of blasted on the scene. And how long did it take you? Like you said thousands. And then also, how did you have to change or prepare that knowledge for being useful in the context of an LLM?
Sure. So I started the Open Nutrient Project originally as a way to kind of do just what the AI is doing, get better understanding of the nutrient components of your property. The original idea was, you can go around your property, use something like iNaturalist or one of the other apps that are out there to make your list of Latin names for your plants. And then you can check them against this database and figure out what you had to work with. That was the original idea before AI. So I started building this database. I got frustrated by not being able to find this information. That's actually how most of the stuff that I've ended up creating comes to be, I do agricultural consulting and I'm like, hey, I need this tool. Oh, wait, that doesn't exist. I need to make it now. So that's kind of was the origin of that. So, and then once I kind of started on that, there's quite a few different, huge databases of nutrients that are out there. It's just a matter of scraping them and, or searching them for those, particular values, and then compiling all of that or exporting it into an Excel and then reformatting all of that data into something that, just has the individual columns and all that. And then, what how I had it formatted out was that we had the Latin names and all that, and then the individual nutrients, and then they were just kind of down, but there's often blanks and zeros and things like that, null values basically. So we had to address all that with, you know, putting a value in that so that the AI could make much better use of it with the numbers, because that was a problem initially that we had to address. And then all, as far as compiling it, it was just a matter, I mean, it took me about a year and a half of just working on it in the evenings a couple times a week, you know, to compile all that data, to get all those different ones into one place. So that was really the heart of it on actually compiling it. It's not so much hard. It is just as tedious.
Just time.
Time consuming.
Just time consuming.
It's definitely something that I do want to find a way to just use like a web scraper or something like that to just actively pull stuff that's available on there. But it was easier just to do it in a couple of other ways. But once we had that data, and you know, it was easy to compare it against the EPA, you know, data for toxicity, and you know, make sure we're avoiding things like arsenic, lead, or cadmium. You know, that could be a potential problem. And that's one of the other things that's built into the AI. It will not give you a high, anything that's going to be over any kind of legal limit or even within 30% of it in terms of heavy metals. So it's at least as far as we're able to have data for. You know, we try to account for things like that as well. So you can't be like, make me a nutrient solution that is super toxic with lead. Like, we don't want people to use it to, like, you know, be hurtful with it. So it's something else too, where we had to think about, like, how could someone use this for evil, and then put some safeguards in it as well, because, you know, you could have someone very unscrupulous, misusing a lot of the nutrient data, you know, in certain instances. And that's not something that we want. But and then as far as making it work with the AI, which a lot of reformatting it. I think we've reformatted the whole database like 5 times to make good it work God. Better, or suddenly realize it needs to be this, that, or the other, or suddenly there's an update to one of the backends, and now everything is, you know, not talking to each other, so we have to adjust it or whatever. So that's been kind of the growing pains on that. But it hasn't been too brutal, aside from just the null value thing took a little bit to figure out. But other than that, the rest of it's been pretty much just, you know, going through the motions and seeing what's not working, and then just addressing it kind of as a step-by-step thing. Again, that's much more of a Caleb or a Roger question on the team than myself. But on the nutrient data table, that one I can speak on, but the others, engineering side of the script writing and, you know, some of that. I knew a little bit on the prompt engineering and the stuff as well, and how we got that to work. But that was, again, that was another bit where we've had to rework it a couple of times to kind of make it do it in the right order so that it comes out in the right format on the output. But I guess that was the short of it on the spreadsheet side.
Have y'all had to largely format manually? Or have y'all actually been able to utilize LLMs, or did they, part of the team or whatever, write scripts and stuff to do that sort of thing? Have y'all been able to automate a lot of it, or is it still just kind of a manual process?
Yeah. So we've had I've been mostly using LLMs for a lot of the formatting stuff, especially when you're working with as many records as we have now. Mm-hmm. It really would be kind of insane to do it manually.
It seemed like it would be, sir.
Yeah. I had a way to export most of the original data out from different websites as an Excel sheet. So that helped a lot with just getting it compiled initially. But yeah, most of it now has just been reformatting it or using LLMs to reformat the data based on, because it's all there. You just have to structure it slightly differently, which is something it's good at. So,
gotcha. So this has been... I've been really interested, like I said, about like the idea of using this application in kind of the real world. And in the sense of like pulling together agricultural information, or I guess really it's just kind of like nutrient and plant information, like how broad is the knowledge base for this, and how broad do you intend it to be? Like, is this an ongoing project that you just kind of keep rolling over as you pull more information? What's the breadth of ways that I could use this, I guess, in
sure
the in that sense?
Sure. So what we're trying to do with it eventually is trying to include as many different plants from as many different continents as we can. Mm-hmm. So we want to really increase the plant database and nutrient database. But a lot of that's limited by the fact that a lot of those plants simply have just never been tested. No one's ever taken them and tested them for the data. So that's been like a big problem. So we've been talking to some of the herbariums. Really, we were kind of surprised. A lot of herbariums actually have a lot of this data too, which is compiled in one form or another. You just have to get them to scan their papers and stuff for you. But that's been a big issue on that. But that's definitely something we're going to be dramatically expanding on. And then as far as new features and other things that we want to do with it, we want to make it languageless so that you'll be able to push mm-hmm. a button instead of having to read. Because, you know, a lot of the world's farmers aren't literate. And I don't mean to say that to put them down. It's just a fact of life. So but they all have cell phones, right? They all make calls and calling out their friends. You know, it doesn't even matter if you're remote Zimbabwe. They use weather balloons out there for the cell phone stations, but they still have a full cell network and you know, even the most remote parts of the world now, just about. So as long as they have access to that and can hit a button on their phone and it can talk to them, that can, you know, solve their problem. So that's something else that we're working on. We're working on expanding the languages. It does a ridiculous number of languages, over 150 languages now. It's pretty wild. It even does like multiple dialects of many different languages, which is super cool. I'm not quite sure where they found the library for that, but it's pretty amazing. Trying to make it this thing is user-friendly as possible for people that just have no background in agriculture. Like, I want some guy that be like, I'm going to feed my family this year and be able to like have this thing guided through any of the problems he runs into. So expanding the pesticide stuff. And then also we're adding in the next version, we're working on multimodal functionality so that we can start doing photographs of insects or molds or plants and you know, integrating a lot of those types of disease recognition and insect recognition for pests and pathogens. So that again, the farmer can just aim it at it, hit the button and be like, tell me what to do. You know, the idea is to just make it this as simplified as possible, and then have a model where, you know, there's a small percentage of people that are supporting the project at a small monthly fee that are getting access to the beta and the latest and greatest stuff. And then the free version, once everything is anything that's stabilized and working really well, goes out to the free version. You know, kind of gives us a way to kind of both have the enough income to pay for the back end, because as you know, if you're building something with this many tentacles, it gets kind of expensive to on the back end. And then also a way to kind of keep it free, because the vast majority of people on this wouldn't be able to afford 10 or 20 bucks a month to, you know, to do that. You know, this is geared towards
especially people it would help the most, like would be in that situation. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we want to make sure that that can still be available for free. So working on that, or maybe even doing something that's geolocation. So if we can see that you're not, you know, you're in Africa or something, we're not going to charge you. But if you're in the, you know, US, maybe we'll ask for a donation, but still make it free kind of thing. Or hey, if you're really getting a lot of useful out of this app, you know, donate what you can kind of thing. And we've managed to really grow it since we started raising money in January. We've really raised quite a bit quickly because people are just really wanting to support the project. You know,
that's awesome.
You know, it's been great. So we have quite a few people now on the beta tier, and then we'll be releasing the first free version in the next month or so. We're down to like the last two bugs before release. So once we get those nailed down in the free version, then that'll be released. And that's the version that we're going to be really building upon. It's slightly different than the paid version that we have right now. The back end is completely different and it allows us to do a lot more. It just wasn't as, you know, we originally did the first one as a proof of concept, and now we're doing it in a way that's going to allow us to really tack on a lot of new things using Hugging Face with the new model versus GPT with the old model. So
this show is brought to you by the Cold Card Hardware Wallet. My favorite setup, which I know I talk about a lot, is the Nunchuck Wallet on mobile that just connects directly to or just talks NFC whenever I need to sign. The Nunchuck does not hold my keys. It is securely on my cold card, not connected to the internet, not vulnerable to a phishing email or any malware or anything like that. If I ever need to send a transaction, I just create the transaction on my Nunchuck wallet and I tap it to my cold card. I hit sign, I tap it again, and then off it goes. There is no easier interface and way of interacting that grants a higher level of security, in my opinion, than that right there. It's genuinely incredible to me that we even have this capability in the Bitcoin space. And CoinKite has just made an entire suite of fascinating security, and just fun Bitcoin devices and hardware products like the block clock. Just connect it to your node and have it show the Bitcoin price, have it show the block height, just right there on your desk in this really cool package. If you haven't checked out what they have to offer, you definitely need to. And don't, when you go over there, do not forget that I have a 9% discount code. Bitcoin Audible, all one word, gets you 9% off. And you can go through the link in the show notes or just remember the discount code, which is not hard. It's just the name of the show. You can go through the link in the show notes to go right there or just go to the store, browse around, see what you want, get yourself a solid hardware wallet, experience the tap to send with a cold card hardware wallet. It's just kind of magical. And get notified for the Q1. I'm really stoked about my Cypherpunk BlackBerry, the new model that's going to be coming out. So check that out as well. Don't forget, 9% off. The link is right in the show notes. Go check them out.
Okay, I was actually about to ask and go in that direction, because you already brought up monetization or the idea of like how to make this sustainable, which was a big thing in my mind, is like, how do you make sure that a project like this stays alive? Also, just kind of on that note, I'm not sure if you guys accept Bitcoin. I hadn't seen anything on it specifically, but if you do ever need help with that, not only are Bitcoiners, I think, pretty interested in this topic, because there's this serious self-sovereignty sort of cultural base, I guess. And a lot of people are thinking about that. It's kind of hilarious the number of people that are, you know, their goals now are to get a farm and, you know, basically live on their own land or whatever, and like produce as much as their own food. There's this big movement in Bitcoin of shake your rancher's hand, so you know where your beef is coming from, you know where you're getting your steaks and that sort of thing. And it's funny too, because I never really thought about that. I sort of did, but I never really took the approach myself. And it's funny, I've done that since. Like it is spreading, and it's interesting in that way. But also just for from your standpoint, or from the receiver's standpoint, the benefit is, you know, you don't have to think about like merchant fees or whatever. You don't have to think about which country you're getting the money from either. You know, like I can send a Lightning payment from the US, from Russia, from India, from China. It doesn't really matter. It's the same. The network has no idea. It doesn't like cost more or take longer, you know, from one place than a different one. That's something that I would highly encourage, and I'm happy to help if you need it. But in sure. A general sense for monetization, is this model open source, you said? And this will probably be related to the other back end question that I was going to ask about. You said the first one was built on GPT. So that this was a knowledge base that did you do like their custom GPT thing where you fine tuned it? Or I guess that one wasn't even a fine tune. What do you know about the details of A, how you got it to GPT to basically be a agricultural GPT, so to speak? And where are you going with you said a Hugging Face model. Is this, are you going to like an open source one like Llama 2? Where's the new infrastructure headed to kind of make this more open and accessible?
Sure. So on the second question, I'm not sure on that. That's not
okay.
I'm the wrong person on the team to ask on that one.
Okay.
On the old one, we utilized a third party group to assemble the whole thing. Well, it was a mixture of stuff that they wrote in Python and then a third party website that it allowed us to connect a lot of the pre-built data to it. It wasn't through a basic GPT because, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but GPTs are pretty limited in the total amount of data that you can actually upload into them. It's pretty limiting. And when we're talking about huge data tables of both all the recipes from all the different types of natural farming methods and organic production, and all of that plant data that goes out to, you know, the 16 different nutrients on that and Latin names and common names and all the rest of it. It's too much. It's way bigger than what you could ever do with GPT. And you know, hey, if someone can prove me wrong or tell me that a different way to do it, then that's fine. But it made much more sense for us to build it on this other platform that we were using. And again, that version really is the little more refined version right now. But the Hugging Face one has a lot more potential to be, you know, added on to significantly more, is my understanding of it. We already have a couple of internal demos of like the voice chat only version and some other stuff that we have that we haven't released yet that is really cool, and working with that version. So, it's kind of going to definitely move in that direction.
Yeah. God, it's crazy how fast this is happening, especially with, I mean, how big would you say your team is? I mean, I guess it kind of changes in the sense you said you have a lot of crowdsourcing and a lot of volunteers and people who are helping out with it as well. But how big would you say the team is that's centrally responsible for the bulk of making this a reality?
Sure. So there's 14 people on the team. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many people are directly working. I know there's about 6 or 8 people that I know I speak to on a weekly basis that are working on the AI. There may or may not be some people in the back end that I don't know about. So I don't mean to hurt anyone's feelings if I'm forgetting you, but that is the sign. And all of us are volunteer. No one on the team gets paid. All of us are put 100% of the funds raised for it. If you do sign up, are just put right towards the cost of it. All of us just do this as a labor of love because it's something that we feel strongly about. And it's something that this tool is going to be able to change the world and feed millions of people, if we can democratize this kind of access to agricultural education, or increase the yields of what they're already doing and allow them to grow organically in a methodology that's just utilizing what's available to them, without having to rely on these, giant companies that are bending them over for, expensive fertilizers or crazy pesticides. This gives them all kinds of different options that they don't have to rely on that kind of stuff. And again, like I talked about before, they can spend that money on the 10,000 other things that are more important in their life than buying fertilizer.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Where do you think your concern or your focus on this, like where did it originally come from?
So mine in particular was, I work in agricultural consulting for mainly medicinal plants, but also organic certified vegetable production, and as well as aquaponic facilities. That's what my specialty in particular is, but also living soil. And I went to Zimbabwe and I saw all that every single agricultural place was Syngenta or Monsanto or one of these other big ag companies. And you're like, I'm in remote Africa. Like, why are they here? Like, they shouldn't, this is a US company that sells corn. Like, why are they in remote Africa? Like, this is screwed up. And then I see the prices of what they're paying, and they're paying like similar prices to the US in terms of cost. And it's like, this is nuts. This is like, again, 80, 90% of their income compared to what it would be to a farmer here. Yeah, it's still expensive, but it's not that percentage of income, right? And in Zimbabwe, they have a program through the government where they have these like little seed shops, and everyone that has a farm can sign up and get an allotment of seeds for their farm for free from the government each year. And then you can, buy more if you want to, but you can grow, they'll give you seeds to grow for your family so you can feed yourself as part of the way to just help the people there. So, but they still have to buy all this expensive fertilizer from these, outside companies that really don't belong there. So when I realized that and I started teaching them some of the Korean natural farming methodologies, it was having transformative effects for a lot of these different farmers. And it was like, okay, so the problem here is just the education component. Like, how do we get them to have that information access in Shona and in Tabele and the other local languages that they need to have? So we can, using AI and LLMs, immediately democratize this type of information and give access to farmers that, ways to just completely cut out that, outside chemical company that's taking all of their income and extracting income from the country, from people that really can't afford to have income extracted from their country. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's crazy. Have you ever heard of the concept called structural adjustment and kind of how the IMF sets up this essentially financing structure that pushes these corporations into these environments through foreign aid?
Oh yeah. The NGO funded stuff. And I've cleaned up after them in a couple of different parts of the world now. And what they do is they just throw money and fertilizer on it, and then they burn the ground. Like, it's a big problem in Zimbabwe where you have other NGOs that tried to feed them after the Rhodesian war, came in and tried to, keep everybody alive, which, hey, their heart was in the right place, man. Like, no, not knocking them at all for that. But the method of execution to achieve that was that they ended up just completely salting the crap out of a lot of traditional fields that have been growing for thousands of years in that part of the world. You know, Zimbabwe was the breadbasket of Africa for a long time before, you know, some of the more recent, you know, since the 70s, is that not so much, but, you know, that's more recent problem. You know, for a long time, that was really healthy, fertile soil that was maintained properly. Now they dumped a bunch of salts on it and killed all the microbes. So there's no microbes that can convert any of those salts anymore. And the nutrient levels are too high. So it's hard to get anything to kind of get established to break that back down. You can take some of the microbial processes like that our AI will teach people and revitalize that land and make it usable again, because it already has the fertilizer in it. You just need to make it bioavailable. You know what I mean? So phosphorus is not in that P2O4 form that it needs to be absorbed by plants, or the iron isn't chelated in a natural form that the plants are usable. It's in an FE3 instead of an FE2 form, or whatever the chemical makeup is for that one. Simply by adding the microbes back, they'll start to do all that and make that land fertile. And you don't even have to fertilize it, because you got 10 years, 20 years of fertilizer that's already in there, that's just in the wrong form. So it allows them to very quickly revitalize these lands that were kind of screwed up by other people that, while they had good intentions, we're not doing it the right way, and ended up really hurting them in the long run, because it worked really good the first couple of years. And then the yields started to go down because the soil was dead. And the other thing too, that happens when you have dead soil, is they get attacked by funguses more often. They don't have the SAR response. So the plant immune system isn't triggered to turn on because of the microbes in the soil. So now it's going to be weaker to insects, because the gene activation in those plants doesn't turn on those defenses and make them more resistant. So you end up with plants that are more mold resistant, more insect or more mold susceptible, more insect susceptible, and you have lower yields because the everything's out of balance. So, you know, while it was great the first couple of years, now you've really screwed it up, and it's harder to fix that, you know, afterwards than it is to just start off with a clean slate. So it really helps a lot of different parts of the world that have been really screwed up by some of these other agriculture practices that hadn't been done right, even if they had good intentions, and allow them to revitalize that and make use of this land as well. Simply by, again, teaching people how to make the right microbial combinations from their property that already exist there, and putting them back on the field.
That's crazy. So let's say, like, in the context of the LLM, let's use this as an example, because this is something where there's actually an unlock available, where the soil is basically going to produce bad crops, but it has everything necessary, if you know how to attack it, to produce great crops. So in that context, how does the LLM take advantage of this? How do you even get the relevant knowledge necessary to know what their ground situation is? Like, is this where you're getting them to do some sort of a testing so that they can put in explicit information about what their soil is like, and then the LLM takes that and, you know, basically pulls through its knowledge base to say, well, this is how you can utilize, you have too much of this, but you can actually unlock it with this fungus or this method that pulls in this sort of microbe or something like that. Like, tell me a little bit more about, you say that, like, you want people who don't know anything about gardening or growing their own stuff to be able to use this. I'm a perfect example, because I don't know jack, and my backyard is clay. And, you know, like, I could probably grow something here, but I have no idea. I actually should probably ask it about the grass, because I've done, like, general, like, searches or whatever about what grass would do well in my yard. But I hate the clay. And so, like, how would I give it enough information for the LLM to know exactly what's in my soil, rather than me just saying, I'm in central North Carolina, I'm in, you know, the Raleigh-Durham area. What if there's something specific to my backyard or just our neighborhood that happened? How could I account for that? And, you know, in the case of Zimbabwe, how does it know exactly? Is there a database there, or does the user need to put in some sort of information?
Sure. So there's a couple of different answers to that. So one, we do have access to there's really good global nutrient databases for, okay, here's the soil type in this, here's the formation, here's the chemical makeup. So you can make a pretty good educated guess, unless someone's really locally dumped a bunch of stuff there, screwed it up. Mm-hmm. A lot of that data is pretty publicly available. It's satellite scanned, a lot of it, and you can find that pretty readily, you know, through lots of different places on the internet. So that's part of that is built into the AI. We do want to upgrade that, but there is a you know, a basic knowledge base of what there is for the soil there already in it. And then the next part of it is that, so if I said, oh, well, you have a lot of clay in your area because you're near a riverbed or whatever, you could say, hey, I have a lot of clay in my soil. Make sure you account for that. And it will go ahead and add more aeration and more organic material into it. That's going to remain as a loose plant material, not a liquefied or other input in your preparation, because it knows that. Especially the newer version is a little bit better with the compost and soil side of soil building than the other one, which is a little bit more focused on nutrient fertilization. So we adjusted that a little bit with the newer version, and it's a little more accounting for that. The other thing too is you could say, okay, well, I got my soil test. I need this many ppms of this, of calcium, this many ppms of phosphorus, this many ppms of potassium, and it will give you exact ranges for that and the dilution rates for the concentrate to get to that based on the average numbers. Now, it will have a slight range to it, because if I grow a cucumber in my yard versus in your yard, we have different minerals in the ground, right? So you're going to have some variation on the potassium levels in it, but it's going to be within a pretty small range, you know, a predictable range, right? So as long as people understand that it's not going to be, you know, to within one ppm difference or whatever, you know, but it will increase your potassium significantly if that's what you're trying to do within a certain range, you can absolutely do that. So it can absolutely give you, okay, I want 200 parts per million calcium and 35 parts per million phosphorus and, you know, 150 parts per million potassium. It'll absolutely do all that. And it has the numbers on the back end to create that and get you close to it. Again, within the margin of error of your local, you know, soil type.
Let's say I do a soil test. I don't know anything about like what parts per million I need. Can I just say I want to grow fescue grass or something, and what parts per million do I need? Can I basically go the reverse?
Yep. So the first thing it does in its logic is, okay, where are you in the world? And then roughly what's going on with your conditions there. And the next thing is, okay, what's the plants that you asked it to grow, and what are their nutrient requirements so that it can build around that, right? So it'll absolutely give you, you could put in your soil type and your soils results and say, hey, this is what I'm growing, this is my soil results, give me a solution that's going to rebalance this out so that it's going to be, you know, proper yields or grow really well or whatever it is that you're trying to do. It'll absolutely do all that in its current form.
That's crazy. Basically what does it do, or what kind of knowledge base do you have for, let's say, aquaponics, let's say like indoor farming, because you're in an area where you're in the city and you literally have no soil. You have no access to that. Is that part of the knowledge base, or is that intended to be at some point?
Yeah, so it's definitely something I'm working on right now. It already does do all of that. The problem that we currently have that I'm working on the filter for is sometimes it'll give you recipes that will have plants in it that will harm fish. So like yucca and certain others, walnuts and some of the other stuff will kill fish if you put it in there. So we're just having to screen it against that and making a, you know, okay, here's all the plants on the list that will kill fish. You know, don't use these for aquaponics. That's something that I'm currently working on right now, but we'll have that available by April. I have a presentation on it in April, so I have to finish it by then.
Interesting. So, okay.
We'll have that available in a future version. That's something else too. I mean, part of the reason why I got into the idea of originally building the Open Nutrient Project was actually speaking to a gentleman named Quan Con Pham. He's episode 251 of my Growing with Fishes podcast, if you want to hear him talk. But he's a guy in Vietnam, and he's doing organic hydroponics and aquaponics utilizing just plant ferments. So he's doing a liquid indigenous microorganism fermentation, where he's taking that same collection we talked about before and then putting it in a barrel with an airstone and is fermenting, you know, actively aerobically fermenting tons of different local plants in individual barrels, and then testing the parts per million of that, and then adding that at specific ratios to you know, fertilize the system. And that's what got me the idea of even trying to make a database like that was his work that he was doing in Vietnam. He was kind of the inspiration for the Open Nutrient Project, which then, you know, turned into the, eventually spawned into the AI. So I guess I should thank him on that one.
That's cool. How did you actually get in touch? How did you cross paths with him or find him?
Sure. So I'm pretty well known in the aquaponics world, and he reached out to me with some chemistry questions and asked if anyone else had done that. And then I was like, no, but that's really cool. And I've done a lot of work with lactobacillus fermentation, where we basically take whey from cheese making and do different ferments in that with insect frass or spirulina or some of these other plant inputs. Horsetail fern is another one that works really well as a lactobacillus ferment for silica bioavailability. And you can put that on your plant. So it's something I was familiar with certain applications, but I never thought about it as doing it as like a hydroponic nutrient solution kind of thing. So, and it works really well as long as you properly balance everything. It works just as well as your chemical fertilizers, and you don't have to buy anything, which is super great.
That's so crazy. So the foundation of the entire idea is really just about, at least a big part of it is, how do you naturally, like, it's almost like a holistic LLM in that sense, that the knowledge base is largely about how do you take advantage of this stuff without glyphosate, without, right. How can you get the pesticide result, so to speak, by utilizing what is naturally available or compensating where necessary. That's such an interesting thing. And I think it's something that's so insanely important. It's one of the things that I talk about. Have you ever read the book Unsettling America?
I haven't, no.
By William... The Unsettling America, it's really good. I'll get you the link to it. And it's actually read by Ron Swanson, the guy who does Ron Swanson. He does a great job with the audiobook. But it's fascinating to me because all of this stuff is so deeply connected to money. And this is like one of the things in unpacking on Bitcoin Audible, my other show, that I have found how unbelievably tied to the concept of financing and how we direct resources, which is literally the game of money. Like, that's the point of the money. So when you corrupt the money, you literally corrupt all of the incentives and the feedback mechanisms for bad processes, for things that do end up, salting the soil. And the Unsettling of America doesn't, the author does not recognize entirely, but it's amazing how much he brings it up, of financing as being a huge part of the problem. And really, I think of it now, when I read the book the first time, I 100% think of it now as a book about the consequences of bad money. But he didn't write it as the consequences of bad money. It's just that if you understand the pieces already, you can see the breadcrumbs. You can see the puzzle pieces fitting together while you're reading the book. But it's a fascinating kind of exploration of, one of the things you brought up earlier was that, like, the seed production, like 90% of the seed production is three companies. How the hell did that happen? How did we actually get there? And that's essentially a huge part of the book is why are we basically a corporate machine, and what's happening to the quality of our soil? Why is holistic farming and regenerative farming basically disappeared? Like these actual sustainable practices, why have we become so disgustingly unsustainable and wasteful in that environment? And you would love the book. I'm 100% certain that you would. I'll send you a link. And I'll put it in the show notes too, for anybody listening. But partly that book, but also some other things I've explored, is that in a political sense, we are totally focused on all the wrong issues. Is that like climate change and like just the major issues that the political space is worried about are not actually the immediate issues. They're not actually the serious concerns that we have. And one of them that is like hugely overlooked is the quality of our soil and the fact that we're slowly but surely destroying it to the point that without these chemicals, it's not even useful. And that we've put these huge centralized third parties that all of this is dependent on. And it's amazing how powerful a tool like this could be to basically reopen kind of a decentralized approach to fixing it. And I've also noticed the rebirth of regenerative farming and holistic farming as an idea. I feel like the momentum is still all small, but I feel like the momentum in growth is speeding up quite a bit. And maybe can you talk to that? Like, what have you seen in that? Are you hopeful in that sense? Or is it just bad news on the horizon and you're just dedicated to trying to fix at least a piece of that shit? I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Sure. Just to further touch on what you were saying right before that, though, glyphosate is another example of that bad money. Glyphosate originally was developed as an edging descaler. It was never had anything to do with agriculture in its original development. They just happened to have discovered that it chelates minerals and kills plants really well. Do you know where the glyphosate-resistant gene that they use in the crops came from? It came from Jimson weed that was growing on the edge of one of the fields they were trying to kill, and they realized it had a gene that could break down the chelate, and they went, let's steal that gene from the Jimson weed and put it in corn and see if it works. Then we can spray the whole field with glyphosate, and it won't kill the corn or the wheat. And that's where your GMO, they didn't engineer
might give you
this
cancer.
Stuff.
But don't worry about that. Just eat it.
Right? This was stuff that survived their efforts to exterminate weeds. And it just happened to find a gene that could deal with it in one of the weeds, the Jimson weeds. So that, you know, a lot of people don't even realize it was never developed for agriculture. It was an engine descaler for motor engine, like big diesel engines. Like that's what it was developed for. So why we ever put it on plants and, you know, causes so many people to get injured. It's nuts. But just to talk on your, you know, having it kind of develop and jump into the commercial side from being kind of a more niche thing on the regenerative practices, the person that taught me the most about it was Chris Trump, who was the kind of the main guy for Korean natural farming in terms of English speakers. And he was in Hawaii and his family had a farm and they had 700 acres of macadamia nuts. And they had basically ran into money to because the yields of the trees, you know, they're older trees, they weren't yielding very well and all that stuff, and they were not really getting the production they needed to keep the farm afloat and all that. And it, basically the one year they didn't have money to do traditional agriculture anymore. So he heard about this thing called Korean natural farming. I said, okay, screw it, we don't have the money to do anything else, so we're going to do this year. And they ended up with 125% more macadamia nuts than the previous year.
Holy crap, 125% more?
Yep. So after a few years, the rest of the island that had been doing traditional cultural practices came to him and was like, what the hell are you doing, dude? Like, can we pay you to teach us what to do? So he's completely transformed the macadamia nut production in the Hawaiian Islands based off of him basically hitting this wall going, I don't have enough money to do it commercially. I got to try this other method because it's the only method that seems like it might work. And it's what I have a budget for. And that allowed
spawned
this whole thing.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah. But you're seeing a lot of people from agricultural world poaching, you know, medicinal plant farmers that have a lot of experience doing this. There's a lot of medicinal plant farms that are growing this methodology that are having amazing success. It's a high dollar crop. So that it's kind of a, hey, it works or it doesn't, you know, and we have enough money to do research on it and actually try it out without having to lose the farm if it doesn't work. And it's allowed us to develop a lot of different methodologies that you otherwise wouldn't. I mean, especially in aquaponics, it's incredibly accelerated aquaponics research because we test every 10 pounds of production of plant material, and we have to by law, right? For pesticide residue, all these other things that they never check for in you know, lettuce production, nor do they have the money to test for all that, right? Because it's lettuce. The margins aren't there.
That seems crazy.
To actually do this science. So it's really accelerated.
You don't have to do it for food.
Yeah. Oh, dude, you wouldn't believe this. So stuff that would fail for more than one part per billion on our crops is allowed at 2 parts per million on grapes, like pesticide-wise.
Holy shit, 3 orders of magnitude?
Yep. The other thing too is there's a lot of pesticides that mycobutanol is perfectly safe to spray on trees and eat, or your cantaloupe or watermelon. But if you take that and burn it, like on tobacco or some other types of burnable plants, it will turn into hydrogen cyanide, which, you know, so some of these, you know, if you burn
them. That sounds safe and healthy.
Right? It's not something you want to breathe directly into your lungs. So. A lot of you have to be careful when you get into combustible plants because it's a whole other realm in terms of, you know, compatibility with combustion. So, with the final product. So that's something else that I have to worry about chemistry wise that, you know, most farmers don't.
That's interesting. So it forces you to change the, because it's particularly damaging in a different way or a more concrete or direct way, I guess, is that it forces you to change how you think about the whole farming process. That's interesting.
Yep. And that's why we rely on like, for instance, almost all the insect control that I do, regardless of the farm now, is either with bacteria or fungi that we can spray on the plants and it will infect them and kill them. It also works really good because if I get an aphid and he's got a bunch of his buddies there and I infect him, well, now it's going to spore and kill all of his buddies too. So you can kind of chain through, you know, bigger outbreaks of stuff and wipe them out. I mean, we had a luck even with the locusts in Africa. With some of these fungi that we were making from the property. So this is stuff that already existed in the local environment there. We just concentrated it on insect frass and then bulked it out and sprayed the fields with it, you know? So and you could spray your kids with it. You can drink the stuff. I've drank a shot. I taught a workshop in November at Jack's when he does his fall meeting, a workshop in November. And I drank a shot glass. A bunch of the students drank a shot glass of it just to kind of show, look, you can't do this with the pesticides you have at the store. I can drink mine. I feel comfortable spraying that around my kids or dogs or neighbors. Mm-hmm. Like if there's a flood and it runs off into the river, the fish are still edible, right? Like you don't have to worry about any of the weird stuff that, you know, you do with most of the other options you would have. So that's one of the other things that I'm really passionate about and I think can help a lot of people just get away from these toxic practices. But in general, the commercial ag side is really seeing that, hey, the pesticide chemical route was like not the way to go. The chemical fertilizer route was not the way to go. We're seeing the difference in the Brix levels and the nutrient, the flavonoid and terpene levels of our lettuce and tomatoes and cucumbers when they're grown with these more microbial dominant methods, because it has that gene activation. The plants are not getting sick as often. You know, you're not having any of these different problems that they're having with this traditional agriculture, and they're converting to it. I mean, you have a lot. BASF is like the biggest producer of beneficial insects and entopathogenic fungi in the United States now, and things like that. And they were like number one chemical producer like 10 years ago. You know what I mean? So a lot of the world's shifting this, but it makes me worried that like they're going to get into some GMO or patented strains of different, you know, microbes that then they could, you know, try to have some, again, try to pull the same crap they did with the pollen and the GMO. The plants, you know, I think that's definitely a negative potential, but right now there's so little study on it and there's so few people that actually understand how a lot of these systems work, you know, top to bottom, that you know, it's so new that they can't really lock it down the same way. Plus, you know, hey, just because a microbe it works really good there doesn't mean I can't find six other ones that'll do the same thing, you know, in terms of insect control or fungal control or whatever. So it makes it harder for them too to kind of chase and patent, you know, from that, you know, just from an evolutionary standpoint.
Yeah, larger, more breadth to attack, basically, larger attack surface, so to speak. How wide is the patent control problem? Like, is it mostly just in, you know, US and the EU, or do some of these companies have global patents, and how far, and like, do they go to Zimbabwe and enforce this, like on local food production and sales? Like how big of a problem is that, I guess, is what I'm asking.
It's definitely a global problem, especially in the seed. Like, there's only so many people that are producing, you know, billions of seeds a year for the agricultural market, right? So all they have to do is control those people, right? And that's really where they've kind of, that's what they've done.
There's a central point of failure and they just attack it.
Yeah, anyone can get heirloom tomatoes from grandma, right? Like, but that grandma is not competing with Monsanto for seed sales. You know what I mean?
But
it's definitely a global problem. It's more enforced in the United States and the EU, but it's definitely, you know, a problem. But what people do in most of the other places, if they try to pull this crap, because they try to do this in Jamaica, they just put the pallets out on the dock and burn them all. They just were like, okay, well, screw you then. We're just going to burn all your seeds and you can get the hell out of here. So that's how it's handled in a lot of the world. Africa, again, they dealt with colonialism. They're not going to put up with it a second time. It's why, you know, I think some of the other events going over there, people thinking they can do certain things in Africa. It's like, no. These are people that have already dealt with that crap. They're not going to do it again. Like they've seen that before. Like, so.
Swan Bitcoin has the full suite of Bitcoin financial services. You can instantly buy with your bank account or wire transfer any amount of Bitcoin up to $10 million worth. and you can easily set up what I have been doing for ages, which is an automatic purchase of Bitcoin on a weekly or monthly basis. You just pick your time frame and then automatically withdraw it to your cold storage. And still they have free withdrawals to self-custody, which I was sure would be gone by now. But you should always treat any custodian as a point of failure. And luckily, you won't have to go anywhere for all of the information and advice you need for why you should withdraw and how to do it safely, because Swan Bitcoin has all of the resources you need and will regularly remind you. About 80% or more of their customers automatically withdraw their coins. That is an amazing feat, if you ask me. Then they also have the Swan IRA if you have a traditional IRA and you want to get it allocated to Bitcoin. And there's so much more. With Swan Private, they have inheritance planning. You also have Swan business accounts, and you can even do Bitcoin as a part of your employee benefit plans. They have an advisory. They have the Swan Vault, a multi-sig service for those who want to have the benefits of holding the majority of their keys, but still also want to be able to rely on a trusted institution in the case of an emergency or a disaster. If you haven't started into Bitcoin yet, Swan is an amazing place to begin. Go to swan.com/guy. The link will be right there in the description. Again, that is swan.com/guy. And they will know that I sent you, and my beautiful face will be right there at the top of the page to greet you. I am a longtime user myself, and a huge thank you to Swan for supporting this show, and I definitely recommend you check them out.
That's interesting. Man, it's crazy. And it's not, it's technology. It's just the access to communication, but it feels like big, big changes have started and are brewing everywhere. You know, it feels like in 20 years, the world's just going to be massively different. And, you know, sometimes I think that might be for the worse, but then a lot of times I feel like so much of the negativity may literally just be because we see things that weren't accessible to us before. You know, it's like we've always been in a neighborhood where two people were just stealing everything and poisoning the well and all of this stuff. And, you know, nobody was aware. Nobody knew that was going on. But then suddenly, you know, you wake up one day and suddenly you're getting information about, like, our well's poisoned. Like there's some really bad stuff in here. You know, like there's these like really negative consequences. So it feels like everything's falling apart because all you're getting is bad news, bad news, bad news. But it's bad news that was present that now we're aware of. And now there's this pressure. There's people like you. There's like that your team and everything that's going on. And recognizing the power and the importance. It's like, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. It's very similar to that. It's this idea that we won't fix things until the pressure is so bad and the recognition is there such that we realize how important it is to actually fix the problem. You know, it's easy to ignore something when it's not in your face, when you can just kind of like, nobody would poison the well. Nobody would do that. This couldn't be possibly happening. Where our crops are down, our yields are down just because of this. It's just happenstance. But when you start to feel it, you know, when it starts to change how and what you can do throughout your day, and you see it over and over again, you get exposed to it again. And then from another direction, oh, nope, definitely looks like somebody's poisoning the well. It provides the push, so to speak, to kind of move us into a better place, to motivate us to actually accomplish and do these things. And it's fascinating to watch. It's from a kind of a sociological point of our perspective, that there's this crazy global sort of movement that has no center, that has no particular group. You know, it's not like some company came and found you and told you to do this. There's no like direct organization. It's just like the pressure is everywhere and it's popping up. It's just popping up in all these different places and all these different disciplines and all these different technologies. And I don't know. It feels like we're just on the cusp, or things are moving for really big change. And I hope to God that that means good things. I certainly think it is, but I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Maybe expand on that a little bit. I'm curious.
Oh yeah. I mean, I definitely think that there's enough firecrackers lit in the world that something's going to happen. You know what I mean? I think it's probably the polite way of putting it. But you know, I think that's why it's important to just stock up on seeds and ammo, you know.
That's the best advice ever. Best question.
You know, those are the two things that'll always maintain trade value. You know, mm-hmm. you don't have to worry about like what happens, an EMP goes off, or you know, a sun flare hits and all the electronics get fried. Seeds and ammo are still super useful, right? Like so.
Are you prepared? Are you prepared? Do you have enough seeds and ammo? Nice.
My fiance has actually been going through and cataloging all of our seed collection because I never had it typed up. And mm-hmm. she's been putting in a data. We have like over 1,000 different types of vegetables and medicinal herbs just in alone. And she's not even through like half of it. So it's pretty wild.
That's amazing. You make me feel unprepared. I'm so unprepared now.
That's like my late night, like one too many beers vice, surfing the web, buying stuff is on a Friday night is buying seeds, like on World Class Seeds or Baker Creek or Seeds Man or any of the other weirder, like niche organic heirloom seed stuff. I love giant vegetables and like I have tons of cool tropical medicinal herbs that I've like, okay, I've gone and worked in the Jamaica and Africa and Thailand and all these other, you know, tropical places. I got tons of herbs and medicinal plants from there and vegetable seed. I have fruit tree seeds from the tropics and there's tons of cool stuff that, you know, wherever I go, I'll start a garden right away. And I also like to teach, like I always start to do a local garden club anywhere I go to and give out seeds so people have them to get their garden started. I'm a big proponent of that. You know, the best way to get people addicted to gardening is just to give them some seeds and tell them what to do, you know, give them a plan and let them grow their first tomato or lettuce and they're hooked, you know.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, we need more people like you, especially, I think, because just the value of that in general is going to, as the problems continue to surface and become more obvious, the skill is that much more necessary. And it's so cool to see a project like this with an LLM that's solely focused on bridging that gap so that LLM makes those skills accessible without needing the skills. You know, like it's kind of like a window into a discipline. It's the great averager is kind of a way that I have explained it or kind of have thought about it more recently, is that like the average knowledge of something or the access to the average for all of the people, because everybody's below average on like 99% of things, right? Like you have a specialty and then everything else, like I know I'm decent at building stuff. Like my dad was a contractor. I'm way, way, way above average on Bitcoin. I've read more about Bitcoin than anybody else, you know, and I've tried to make myself well above average on AI. I'm trying to understand this as much as I can because I think it's a super potent tool. But like everything else, way below average, you know, like there's just not my, I mean, like I said, I would know the first thing about like how to properly grow anything in my backyard, let alone grass. I've had enough trouble with that. And this gains, this allows me to kind of access that baseline of like, there's no reason that this knowledge shouldn't be accessible. You know, like it's out there, it's available. The question is, how do you filter it? How do you package it in such a way that it can be accessible by the average person? And the idea of the LLMs and like attached to these knowledge bases is such an unlocking tool. Such an unlocking tool. It's incredible. It's just incredible. So
I wanted to show you here. I'll show you. This is the GPT based one. Mm-hmm. So we asked it a quick question. It says, I'm in Washington State. I'm hoping to save money, reduce urban tech, making my own fertilizers. I have an eighth of an acre of heirloom corn, a quarter acre garden with various brassicas and spicy pepper crops. So then it goes through and says, okay, here's some ideas on your recipe. Here's some local plants that you should be able to source in your area. Nettles, comfrey, dandelion, yarrow, horsetail. Explains which of the nutrients you're going to gain from them, from each one. Not all of them, but, you know, it balances around that. Mm-hmm. And then it gives you detailed recipes on, okay, you need this many kilograms of nettles, this many kilograms of comfrey, brown sugar, and so forth. It also does imperial too. So if you're not a metric user, it'll do American as well. And then gives you detailed recipes on how to do it. And then gives you the nutrient tables on that. And then gives you your dosing recipes.
Holy
and
says, shit, okay, this is involved. Yeah.
Here's your dilution rates for each of them. And then add this early on, you know, middle of the season, later season. Then you can say, give me an exact schedule by week, or, you know, you can be even be more detailed if you wanted to on the output. It also does, like I say, my
words of encouragement. I love it.
Have powdery mildew. What can I do to treat it? And then it'll go through and say, okay, well, powdery mildew is really common here. Here's, you know, lactobacillus serum, the lactobacillus we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. Here's your rice collection, your fermentation and your use for that, your application rates and all that stuff. So it'll go into that. It'll also go into water soluble calcium phosphate, which is also really good for killing powdery mildew. Again, something you can make on site. And then it also gives you some strategies on prevention, and again, application rates down to, you know, exactly the size of you can say I have 4 pepper plants growing on my windowsill, or I have 40 acres or 400 acres. It'll do that. And we'll actually be using this for managing 30 acres of hay this year for a project, and just letting the AI drive. So that, you know, it'll kind of proof of concept it on a really large scale firsthand. Yep.
That's so cool. That's so neat. Oh,
but I could also be like, okay, okay, answer that in Hindi. And then it'll give me the recipe in Hindi for that same treatment for powdery mildew. You know, so this allows us people to, you know, as long as they have a rough idea what they're dealing with, they can ask it. But in the future, they'll be able to just take a picture of the leaf and be like, I don't know what's wrong. And then it'll give it to the thing in their local language, you know, once they set the language to it. So,
dude, for anybody listening to this on the audio version of the podcast, if you do nothing else, go watch the video on YouTube and just jump to, I guess we're like an hour and 17 minutes into it, so there'll probably be like a little intro, but jump to right around there just so you can see this. This is cool. This is really neat. The depth of the answer is kind of crazy. How do you have the, how difficult is the translation problem? Like, so in a couple of the translation tools that I've dug into for LLMs, you said you had 150. Is that right with this already?
Yeah. We've tested it. I tested like between me and a couple of other people, we've tested well over 120, 130 languages. And I know we've added some since then. So that's where the 150 comes from.
Wow. How complicated, and what's the degree of like kind of error rate in translation? Because I've not found perfect translation. You know, translation is a messy process. Break down a little bit about the complications and positives at the same time.
So a lot of it too is having it to try and, you know, look for the local word for the plants too. So sometimes it'll have, you know, that's why we try to build the whole thing around the Latin names of the plants, because sometimes they'll have radically different, you know, what they call it in Pakistan might be different than what they call it in India versus what they call it in Southern India, you know, that kind of thing. So that was something that you kind of trying to have multiple names for the plants as well as possible. But then again, structuring it on scientific names so that it doesn't matter as much, because a scientific name is a scientific name. It doesn't matter if
it's the same in
Hindi
all languages,
or in English or So that's the key to it.
That's smart, because it's a totem to kind of compare. So like when there is a difficulty in language translation or there's a common name, is that it's kind of the thing that you can reference down and then back up to make sure that the language is actually properly connected. That's an interesting strategy. That works.
That was that part of it. And then it does do a little bit of adjustments with the translations, but everyone that we've had and tried, I mean, I have a couple people in Thailand that are using this on a daily basis and stuff like that are having no issues. I can have an answer in Spanish. Oh, did I just hit the wrong button here? Okay. Answer in Spanish. So, you know, it'll give you whatever you want. any of the major languages, basically, at this point. It does do, it had some problems with like indigenous languages and some of the African languages that I wanted to add. It was missing a couple of those, but it's basically does anything that's remotely, you know, common to any large population at this point, that I'm aware of, at least.
That's so, so cool.
And it will adjust them too. Like sometimes it'll adjust it, the recipe a little bit, because it's like, okay, well, if they're speaking that language, they're probably in this part of the world. And then it'll just sometimes adjust the recipe slightly, in the translation. So, or maybe it just has,
doesn't have a
way to adjust it language wise. I'm not quite sure the reason on it, but I do know that it does take into that account to a slight degree.
Interesting. I've had like a couple of interesting problems with translation in my own stuff. It's more voice related, I think, just because what I would hoping to do with this podcast as well, but Bitcoin Audible more specifically, is, you know, produce Spanish versions of it, and it usually doesn't have like a perfect one-to-one translation, and I'm mostly having people go back and or thinking of, at least I've been speaking to people to do this, to basically read the translation and pinpoint out where it's wrong, where like it's just the sentence is odd, or the way that like I've used some sort of idiom or something in the English language that just does not at all, you know, translate, which I guess when you're talking about like specific knowledge, or like very concrete stuff, like the data points here, that's less of a problem, you know. There won't be a lot of idioms, whereas I'll just say a bunch of analogies or just bullshit that pops out of my mouth while I'm talking on the podcast. I do remember the point. There was a different thing. There was on the infrastructure. So this is this one's running on ChatGPT, the one you just showed me. It's the old version, you said. You said the new one is going to be running on a Hugging Face model. How do you deal with, and what are the relevant costs to the infrastructure to get this running? Granted, I think all of this is going to fall. I've seen a couple of recent tools in the AI space that have hugely sped up these tools. Even on like normal hardware, the chat with RTX, the NVIDIA tool that just came out, is really fast. And I've seen some really cool things there, but maybe just speak on that for the degree that you have knowledge to it, I guess.
Sure. As far as switching over to Hugging Face, we've had to restructure some of the data to make it more digestible for the rags and stuff like that on it. But I'm miseven pronouncing that. That's I guess the extent that I know about it. I just know that with this version that we have a lot more ability to customize it and, you know, get it to do things that we wanted to do that we were running into problems with GPT with, because GPT isn't always really good with number stuff. Like we were having problems, some of the calculation stuff, and there's modules you can put in with Hugging Face that make it much, much better at math and things like that. I know that was some of the problems that we were running into in the discussion. So I can happily get Caleb or somebody on, or Roger on, that can go to unteenth detail on those particular topics, but I'm more of the making sure it's giving correct information on the regurgitation end and input end on that, rather than the engineering side as much.
Gotcha. Well, maybe that would be a good thing for a future episode when, you know, new version and like expanding it or something is like really break down into the nit and gritty of the engineering side of stuff. So maybe we'll just put a pin in that and do that at a future date or something.
Sure. Yeah, no, I'd love to get him on, and he could definitely speak more to that side of the project. But you can see here, it gives very similar answers. You know, this is for peppers and lettuce and tomatoes and 4x4 beds. And you can see here, it gives, you know, same weight, you know, things, just a slightly different choice. This is used yellow dock and wood ash instead. So it's a little bit more of the other natural inputs on this database. It's a little bit bigger and easier to manage. That side. And then, you know, again, same kind of instructions on preparations and all your stuff, and then feeding schedule and all that. And then here's the same question. I got powdery or aphids on my peppers. So it talks about physical removal, water removal, you know, some plants that attract beneficial insects that will prey on them. You know, a couple of different options for essential oil treatments and things like that, insecticidal soap. So it tries to give you, you know, eco-friendly options. Down the line, and and all that. So again, doesn't have all the different inputs that we have built into the other one yet, but it's just taken a little bit of time to reformat some of that stuff to make it a little bit better for Hugging Face.
Sweet. Well, hell, this has been really neat. It went a little bit deeper than I had even thought. This is cool. I'm really glad I had you on the show, man. And this is definitely something I'm going to pay a little bit closer attention to. And because it was always already this is just such a cool application. And I think I'm actually going to use this to make a decision about my grass, which is very minor, but I don't know. It's gotten me want to go down that route. And I've thought about doing, small garden or maybe even growing something indoors just for supplement, just because I've been in that perspective. And like I say, the Bitcoin culture has pushed me in the direction of, I do shake my rancher's hand and, that sort of thing. And so I talk with him a lot, and this might actually be something that I bring up with him. I'm sure that he and like other people in that area, the farmer's market that I go to, would be fascinated by this. So I'll spread the word around and see if I can't get their feedback and see how they tackle it and what they find and stuff like that. Maybe somebody has something to add to the knowledge base as well. A crowdsourced project like this that helps a lot of different people and a lot of different minds tackling the same problem. So
sure,
really cool. Thank you for building this, for being the person in the group, that has kind of pioneered or pushed in that direction, because I think we need more of it. We need it everywhere. And it's cool to see it. It's cool to see it, especially in an area that I'm not familiar with at all. So hell yeah, man.
And it works good for ranching too. We have some people that have used these same methods, not using the AI, but the same natural farming methods. There's a gentleman, we like to call him Cowboy, who came to one of the medicinal plant convention summits that we were doing in California. We'll leave it at that to keep the sensor bots away. And because I have a channel, and man, they love to hit my channel hard for not saying medicinal plants. he came out and he was like, well, I heard about this. I want to try it. I have 80,000 acres. And he tried it on, I forget what the paddock was. It was like 400 acres or 4,000 acres, whatever the small area he has for raising the moms and the calves, like when they calve out. He had 35% higher survival rate to adult from his calving than he did the previous year. After the first year of using the natural farming practices, because the nutrients were, the grass was much more nutrient dense. So the cows had a much better, the mothers were healthier. They, some of them produced twins that both survived and didn't have any problems. And they also had, just better milk production and just everything, that the whole system was healthier, because of it. So, it's also,
that's so cool.
Even at that scale or ranch scale, these types of tools can work just as well and help you better utilize the plants that are growing in your area. You got a bunch of areas with a bunch of invasive plants. Put those invasive plants to work on the farm, get rid of them and make them produce something for you rather than just being a nuisance.
Yeah. Dude, if you could give me that explicit case, or I guess actually I can just pull it. I'll pull it from the transcript from the show. But I'm actually going to share that story specifically with my rancher, with the guy that I talked to about this, because that's interesting. And I highly, highly suspect that level is probably not addressed by most people in that situation, that recognizing 35%, that's huge. That's a big deal. Those margins are small. Margins are small all over the place. And then the person you were talking about that had 125% with the macadamia nut in Hawaii. That's crazy, man. It makes you realize, it makes me look at the world again and just recognize that there's an unbelievable amount of potential that's sitting on the table. It's just not utilized. And it's there. It's there for everyone who can figure out the tools, for the people who can build the tools, and to find it. Like, this is such a potent way to unlock an incredible amount of opportunity. So I am definitely going to extend that I haven't been in a couple of weeks anyway. So it'll be good to refresh the conversation and be able to add this in. Dude, thanks for coming on. Is there anything else you want to share, or like final words and how to get in touch, where to follow you, that sort of stuff? How do people follow the project?
Sure. So if people want to check out the project, they can check us out here at copyleftcultivars.com. They can, you know, if they want to get involved, or if, you know, they're otherwise wanting to get part to become part of the team or donate to us, you can donate to us there. You can also, you know, just write us an email. If you have a suggestion or something, you know, feel free to write us anytime. If you want to have access to the AI, for the newest versions and all that, you can check us out over on Patreon. That's how we're doing a large amount of our funding right now. So we have a couple of other bigger backers that are just donating it to us as a grant. We are a 501c3, so you can donate to us and write it off on your taxes if you want to. So it is also an option for people if that's what they want to do. But you can just sign up on here. You can also sign up for free on the mailing list on both websites, and we'll email you every time we have an update with the software, or when we do the free release here in a couple of weeks. If you don't have the funds for it, but if you do, we do have a $20 recommended donation, but for $10, you can get access to the latest and greatest of what we're working on as a means to fund the project. I guess that's that. If people want to listen to my podcast ever, you can check me out on Growing with Fishes podcast on all the different platforms, or even on Rumble and Odyssey and stuff like that as well. I think we're missing a couple episodes on there, but the auto sync for YouTube got broken a couple weeks ago and I didn't realize it. So I will fix that for anyone that's wondering, but you can find me on there as well. If people are wanting to learn more about me and what I do.
Hell yeah, man. Hell yeah, man. All right. Well, stay in touch. Thanks for coming on, and appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thanks for giving me the time, and thanks for letting me come on and talk about our agriculture AI efforts.
Hell yeah, man.